detectives, coroners, forensic specialists. The sign was on the door next to the side-by-side garage doors. The building was freestanding, but literally no more than 2 feet away from the identical structures on either side of it. Ballard knocked on the door, though she did not expect any sort of response. She stepped back and looked up and down the access lane, checking to see if her knock on the hollow metal had aroused any interest. It had not. Ballard stepped over to the thin channel between CCB and its neighbor to the north, a building with no sign or other identifiers on it. The alley, if it was big enough to be classified as such, was unlit. Ballard poked a flashlight into the space and saw it was strewn with debris, but passable. At the far end, which Ballard guessed was 80 feet away, there was no gate or other obstacle. Ballard tentatively stuck 1 foot into the slim opening. She kicked away a pile of old and dusty breathing masks that she could only imagine had come from CCB. Another step in, and then there was no longer anything tentative about her advance. She moved quickly down the passage, concrete block walls on either side of her, toward the opening ahead. Remembering the old movie gag about the walls closing in on the hero, she thought herself into a bout of vertigo and had to put one hand out on one of the walls for support and to keep her balance. She stumbled out of the narrow opening and into a rear alley and bent over, hands on knees, and waited for the dizziness to pass. When it did, she straightened up and looked around. It was the cleanest alley she had ever seen. No debris, no junk, no impromptu storage of old vehicles or anything else. Each unit had its own neatly kept and closed trash bin that was secured inside a concrete corral. Ballard opened the bin behind CCB and found it empty, except for a couple of crumpled to-go bags and several empty coffee cups. Ballard expected there to be bloody mop heads and other debris from cleaning crime scenes, but nothing like that was here. There was a single rear door with just CCB painted on it. Ballard checked it, but it was locked with a deadbolt. She knocked anyway to complete the due diligence, but did not wait by the door for a reply she was confident wasn't coming. Moving back into the narrow passage between the buildings, she shone the light up the walls to the slim slice of night sky. The roof line was about 20 feet up. Because the warehouse was windowless, she knew there was a strong possibility that there would be a skylight on the roof to allow in natural light as well as ventilation. Ballard put the end of the flashlight in her mouth and then a hand on each of the walls of the 2 buildings she stood between. She then raised her left foot and angled it against 1 wall, using the mortar line between 2 of the concrete blocks to find a shallow toehold. Pressing her hands against the wall and gripping the edges higher up, she raised herself up and brought her right foot against the opposite wall, angling it until it found purchase. She was wearing rubber-soled work shoes favored by professionals who worked a lot on their feet. They were chosen for comfort over style, and they grabbed the edges of the mortar lines well. Ballard slowly started climbing up the walls of the passage between the 2 buildings, using her weight to counterbalance her body and to keep from falling. The ascent was slow, and it was toward a complete unknown, but she pressed on, pausing once when she heard a car in the entrance lane of the industrial park. She quickly grabbed the flashlight out of her mouth and switched it off. She was halfway up the climb and could do nothing but hold still. The car out in the lane drove by the passage without stopping. Ballard waited a moment, then turned the flashlight back on and started climbing again. It took 10 minutes to reach the top, and then Ballard put her arm over the parapet around the roof of the CCB warehouse and carefully pulled her body over and onto the gravel rooftop. She stayed on her back for almost a minute, catching her breath and looking up at the dark sky. She rolled onto her side and got up. Brushing off her clothes, She knew that she had burned through another suit. She was planning to take Monday and Tuesday off once her partner returned. She would complete all her laundry errands then. Ballard looked around and saw that she had been wrong about there being a skylight on the roof. There were actually four of them, two over each garage bay, plastic bubbles shining in the moonlight. There was also a steel exhaust chimney that rose 6 feet above the roofline. The diffuser at the top was coated black by smoke and creosote. Ballard inspected the skylights, moving from one to another with her flashlight, stepping around a pool of standing water that covered part of the roof. There were no lights on in the CCB warehouse below, but it didn't matter. Visibility with the flashlight was limited. It appeared that each of the once clear plastic bubbles had been haphazardly sprayed with white paint from the inside. This was curious to Ballard. It appeared to be a move designed to keep anyone from looking down at activities below. But there were no taller buildings in the area with views through the skylights. Ballard thought about the boys caught earlier in the week, attempting to glimpse naked women through the skylights of a strip club. Here, the attempt at skylight privacy seemed unwarranted. Each of the skylights was hinged on one edge and could presumably be opened from within. This was the moment of decision. She had certainly already trespassed on private property, but she would be crossing a more important line if she took things further. It was a line she had crossed before. She had no direct evidence of anything but plenty of circumstantial facts that pointed the needle toward Dylan. She had the fact that the crime scene cleaner was in Hollywood with his van and his chemicals and cleansers on the night Daisy Clayton was taken. And she had the fact that he had ordered storage containers with the same brand mark that had ended up on the victim's body, and in the size that would have been used to store and bleach it. The circumstances of the murder pointed to a killer who knew something about law enforcement and took the effort to rid the body of potential evidence to an extreme level. She knew she could call Judge Wickwire, her go-to, and run these things by her in an effort to establish probable cause. But in her mind, she could hear the judge's voice saying, "Renee, I don't think you have it." But Ballard thought she did have the right man. She decided she had come this far and was not turning around. She reached into a pocket and took out a pair of rubber gloves. Then she started checking the skylights. Each of the rooftop bubbles was locked, but one of them felt loose on its frame. She moved around it, stepping in the water that had accumulated around its rear edge. The standing water was apparently a long-time problem. The moisture had worked its corrosive magic on the skylight's hinges. Ballard put the light in her mouth and reached down with both hands to the frame. She pulled up, and the hinge screws gave way, coming out of the wet plaster abutment below the frame without protest. She pushed the skylight up until it rolled back on its rounded surface and into the water. She pointed her light down and was looking at the flat white top of a box truck parked in the bay directly below the opening. Ballard estimated that it was a drop of no more than 8 feet. Chapter 46. Ballard lowered herself through the roof opening and hung for a moment by her hands before letting go and falling to the roof of the truck. She hit it off balance and fell onto her back, momentarily stunning herself and leaving a dent on the truck's roof. After lying still and recovering for a few seconds, she crawled toward the front of the truck, slipped down onto the cab, and then climbed down the side of it, using the side view mirror and door handle as toe holds and grips. Once she was on the concrete floor, Ballard checked the warehouse's doors to see if she would have a quick escape route if needed. But the deadbolts on both front and back doors required a key on the inside as well. With her flashlight in hand, she located a panel next to the front door with what she believed were the garage door switches. But, like the doors, These required a key to operate. Ballard realized that she was going to have to figure out how to get up and out through the skylight, or somehow break down one of the doors. Neither was a good choice. Below the garage door panel was a row of light switches that were not key-controlled. She flicked them up, and two rows of overhead fluorescents came on, brightly lighting the warehouse. She stood there for a long moment, studying the layout of the place. The two side-by-side parking bays took up the front half of the warehouse, while the rear half was dedicated to the storage of supplies and a small office area with a couch. In the corner opposite the office was an incinerator for burning the biologically hazardous materials collected at crime scenes. One of the parking bays was empty, but there were fresh oil drips on the floor where a truck would normally sit. Ballard knew that the truck backed into the other bay was not the one she had seen earlier in the week when she had met Dylan. It was painted differently, with the full name of the company on the driver's side door and not the large CCB across the side panel. It was older, had low air in its tires, and appeared to her to have been sitting in disuse. It seemed to put the lie to what Dylan had said about having two trucks and four employees ready to go 24/7. He apparently was a one-man operation. It all added up to Ballard, realizing that the truck Dylan currently used was out there somewhere, and she had no idea if he was on a job and could arrive back at the warehouse at any time, or if he simply took his work truck home at night. It didn't seem to Ballard that it would go over well with fellow residents to park a biohazard truck in the neighborhood. But Ballard had not seen any personal car that could belong to Dylan parked near the warehouse. She decided to move quickly with her search and started with a survey of the desk standing against the wall near the rear door of the warehouse. Ballard scanned for any information or notation about a job that might give her an idea of where Dylan and the truck were. But after finding nothing, she moved on, attempting to open the desk's file drawers to see if there were any historical records regarding the purchase of supplies from American Storage Products. The drawers were locked, and that ended her search of the desk. The warehouse was neat and orderly. Against the wall opposite the incinerator were large plastic barrels containing cleaning and disinfecting liquids, with hand pumps for filling smaller containers for use on individual jobs. There were shelves stacked high with empty plastic containers. Ballard checked these for size and the ASP logo that had left a mark on Daisy Clayton, but there was nothing that would be large enough to contain her body, and nothing with the logo. She realized that she had neglected to ask Middleburg the time frame of the orders from CCB that he had seen on his computer. There was a small bathroom with a shower, and it looked like it had been recently cleaned. She opened the medicine cabinet and found routine first aid materials on its shelves. Next to the bathroom was a closet in which Ballard found several white jumpsuits on hangers, CCB embroidered on the left breast pocket of each, and Roger on the right. Further evidence that Dylan's claim of fielding four employees was self-aggrandizement. Ballard closed the closet and stepped over to the incinerator. It was a square standalone appliance with stainless steel sidings and an exhaust pipe going straight up through the ceiling. The front was double-doored, and a matching stainless steel staging table was positioned in front of it. Ballard opened one of the doors of the burning chamber, and the other opened automatically with it. She pointed the beam of her flashlight inside and got a sharp kickback of reflecting light. The interior panels of the chamber were so clean as to be shiny, and it looked like the ash trap below the flame bars had been vacuumed after its last use. The incinerator looked brand new. She could see a gas pilot light burning blue in the back corner. She closed the incinerator doors and turned around. She saw no shop vac or any other kind of vacuum that could have been used to clean it. She then remembered seeing equipment in the truck Dylan had driven to the job site earlier in the week, and assumed that he carried both wet and dry vacuums with him. This thought drew her focus to the truck parked in the second bay. It was the last place for her to search. It had been backed into the warehouse, and she was staring at the two double doors of the rear compartment. Ballard next checked the license plate. The registration sticker was 2 years out of date. It was clear this truck was not part of CCB's active fleet. She pulled back a handle that disengaged upper and lower locking pins on the doors and pulled one of them open. She stepped back to swing it to the side and saw that the truck might have been taken out of service, but it was being used as storage. It was full of cleaning and containment supplies, packaged in bulk. A tower of 24 packs of paper towel rolls, 5-gallon containers of soap, a trash can full of brand new mops, plastic-wrapped cases of aerosol cleaners and air fresheners. Leaning against one side of the interior was a thick stack of cardboard boxes that needed to be folded into shape for use. It was essentially a wall of supplies that blocked her view into the truck. There was a handle mounted just inside the door. Ballard grabbed it and pulled herself up, using the truck's rear bumper as a step. The inside of the truck was shielded from the fluorescence. Ballard used her light to cut through the shadows and look farther in. She quickly realized that the supplies were stacked at the back of the truck only as a blind, and that there was an open space behind them. She shoved the trash can and mops in and out of the way and moved into the truck to look. On the floor there were some old food wrappers, napkins, and fast food bags strewn around a thin mattress that looked like it had been taken from a folding cot. A dirty blanket and pillow were thrown haphazardly on top of it, and a battery-operated lantern was on the floor. Ballard moved the blanket with her foot and exposed a metal loop bolted to the floor of the truck. She squatted down and looked closely at it, saw the scratch marks on the interior of the loop, and knew it could be used to handcuff or chain a person to the mattress. She noticed that there was a slightly sour smell to this area of the truck. It told Ballard someone had recently been inhabiting this space. Ballard suddenly knew that it was the scent of fear. She had recognized it in herself before. She had heard of dogs trained to track it. Ballard knew she was in a place where someone had trembled and feared for her life. Something on the floor next to the mattress caught her eye, and Ballard leaned farther down to look. On closer examination, she realized it was a broken fingernail that had been painted pink. The truck suddenly started shaking as a sharp metallic sound engulfed the warehouse. Ballard's first thought was earthquake, but then she had quickly identified it as one of the aluminum garage doors rolling up. Someone was about to enter. She killed the flashlight, pulled her weapon, and thought about quickly climbing out of the truck, but that would put her out in the open and exposed. She held her place and listened. She heard the high idle of a truck engine, but no movement. Then the engine revved and the vehicle entered the garage. After Ballard judged that it was in the bay next to her, the engine was killed. Again, for several seconds, there was only silence. Ballard didn't even hear the sound of anyone getting out of the cab. And then the ratcheting sound of the garage door began again, this time as it was lowered. Ballard listened intently, her ears her only tool at the moment. She had to assume that the driver of the truck was Dylan. She listed three things in her mind that he could have noticed upon his arrival. The lights of the warehouse were on. One of the out-of-service truck's back doors was standing open, and there was a missing skylight above. She had to assume that Dylan would notice all three and be aware that there had been a break-in. It remained to be seen if he thought the intruder had come and gone or was still in the warehouse. If he called 911, Ballard knew she would probably be arrested and her career would be over. If he chose not to call, then he would be confirming that he didn't want police in the warehouse because of the things that had gone on in here. She flashed on the incinerator, its exhaust pipe coated black on the roof from use, but its burning chamber spotlessly cleaned and vacuumed. Ballard looked down at the thin mattress on the floor. She wondered if she would ever know who had been in this dark place, and shivered under the thin blanket. Who had broken her nail trying to find an escape route? Her anger toward Dylan began to grow to the point of no return, to the killing place she knew she carried inside. Ballard heard the door of the other truck open and its occupant climb out and drop to the concrete floor. Her only view out to the warehouse was through the open door at the back of the truck she was in, and that gave a tight angle of the space beyond. She waited and listened, trying to pick up Dylan's footsteps and movements, but hearing nothing. Suddenly, the back door of the truck she hid in was slammed shut, plunging Ballard into darkness. She heard the handle on the outside turn and the locking pins at the top and bottom of the door snap into place. She was locked in. She gripped her gun in one hand and the flashlight in the other, but chose to stay in darkness, thinking it might keep her ears sharper.
"Okay, I know you're in there. Who are you?"
Ballard froze. Though she had spoken to Dylan only once before, she knew it was his voice. She said nothing in return.
"Looks like you broke my skylight pretty good.
And that makes me mad because I don't have the money for that." Ballard pulled her phone and checked the screen. She was basically in a metal box inside a concrete box, and she had no service. And the rover she had taken from the station was sitting in the mobile charger in her car 2 blocks away. Dylan started pounding on the door, a sharp metal-on-metal sound.
"Come on, talk to me. Maybe you agree to pay the damages and I don't call the cops. How about that?"
Ballard knew there was no way he was going to call the police, not with what she had found in the truck. She needed to put that in her favor. She started to make her way toward the truck's back doors. She had the gun. Most burglars don't carry firearms because it increases prison time if they are caught. Dylan would not anticipate her having one. She startled when he hit the door again.
"You hear that? I've got a gun and I'm not fucking around. You need to tell me you are ready to come out with your hands where I can see them."
That changed things. Ballard stopped moving forward and slowly crouched down to the floor in case Dylan started shooting through the thin steel skin of the truck. She held her weapon in a two-handed grip and was ready to approximate the origin of shots and fire back.
"Okay, fuck it. I'm opening the door and I'm just going to start shooting. It'll be self-defense. I know lots of cops and they'll believe me. You'll be dead and I'll..."
There was a loud bang on the back door of the truck. This one, not metal on metal, and Dylan didn't finish the threat. This was followed by the sound of metal clattering on the concrete. Ballard assumed that it was Dylan's gun skittering across the floor. She knew at this point that there was a second person out there. The handle on the truck's back door was turned, and the upper and lower locks released. The door opened, flooding the inside of the box with light. Ballard kept in a low crouch, using the trash can and mops as a blind. She raised her weapon to ready position.
"Renee, you in there? It's all clear."
It was Bosch.
Bosch. Chapter 47. Bosch helped Ballard out of the back of the truck and down to the ground. The man he had hit with his gun was still on the floor and unconscious. Ballard looked at him after climbing down. "Is that Dylan?" Bosch asked. "It's him," Ballard said. She turned and looked at Bosch. "How did you find me?" she asked. "I thought maybe you were up at the SIS scene." I was, but I got out of there because you and I were supposed to work, Bosch said. But when I got to Hollywood, you were gone. I talked to Money, and he gave me the card you left. Bosch pointed to the man on the floor. I pull up here, and he was opening the garage. I could tell that something was wrong by the way he was hesitating and looking around before driving in. I figured that you were inside. I snuck in behind his truck before he brought down the door. Well, I guess we're even, then. You saved me. You had your weapons. You would have taken care of things, I think. I don't know about that. I do. When I said weapons, I meant more than your gun. I know what you can do. Bosch looked down at Dylan's body, still unconscious and prone on the floor. I don't have cuffs, Bosch said. I do, Ballard said. She stepped forward, taking the cuffs off the back of her belt. Hold on a second, Bosch said. He moved toward the shelves where supplies were stocked and stopped to pick up Dylan's gun and snug it into his waistband. He then grabbed a roll of duct tape and came back. Keep your cuffs, he said. Let's do it this way. Why, Ballard asked. We have to call it in. We? Not you. You get out of here. I'll handle it. No, I'm not going to let them blame you for what I did. If anybody gets fired, it's going to be me. Bosch spoke as he used the tape to bind Dylan's wrists and then feet. I can't get fired. I don't have a job, remember? You need to go now and leave all this to me. What about evidence? There's a mattress and food wrappings in the truck. I found a pink fingernail. He didn't stop with Daisy Clayton. I know. He just got better at it. He glanced over his shoulder at the incinerator and then back up at Ballard. I bet he didn't have this place back then. With Daisy, he said. Or that incinerator. Ballard nodded somberly. I wonder how many, she said. Bosch took strips of tape and put them across Dylan's mouth and eyes. I'm going to try to find that out as soon as you're out of here, he said. Hurry, Ballard said. Go now. Go back to the station and ask Money if I ever came by. Say you never saw me. You sure about this? I'm sure. It's the only way. When I have everything ready, I'll call it into Van Nuys' division, and I'll let you know. No blowback on you. If they get mad at someone, it will be me. But they'll have to think real hard about that, if I offer them this guy in a package wrapped in audio tape. What tape? I've got a tape recorder in my car. Dylan suddenly groaned and shook his body. He was coming to and realizing his situation. He tried to yell something through the tape that was gagging him. Bosch looked at Ballard and put a finger on his mouth for silence, then twirled it in the air. It was time for her to get moving. Ballard pointed to the locked door at the front of the warehouse and made a signal like she was turning a lock with a key. Bosch nodded and leaned down next to Dylan's body. He started checking his pockets for keys. Dylan loudly objected, yelling nonsensically through the duct tape. Sorry, buddy, Bosch said. Just checking the pockets for weapons and other bad things. He pulled out a set of keys and signaled Ballard to follow him, then unlocked the door and walked her out. He saw his car where he had left it parked in front of one of the other warehouses down the line. He spoke quietly to Ballard. Keep your eyes on him for a second while I pull my car up and grab some gloves and the recorder. Just stay here by the door. Will do, Ballard whispered. Bosch walked off. Ballard stopped him. Harry? He looked back at her. Thanks. You already said that. That was for before. This is for you taking the weight on this. What weight? It'll be a breeze. He headed off toward his car. Ballard watched him go. Chapter 48. Bosch was alone with Roger Dillon now. He had him propped up against one of the big barrels full of cleaning solvents. Bosch had forcefully pulled the tape off his captive's mouth, eliciting loud cries of pain and subsequent cursing. He'd left his eyes covered. Before yanking the tape, Bosch had moved around the warehouse, planning and prepping for the interview. He had pulled the chair away from the desk and set it 5 feet away from Dylan, front and center. He had cut the tape around Dylan's ankles, and spread his legs on the concrete floor. Bosch put two metal mop buckets on the floor on either side of his chair. One had 2 inches of water in it. Into the other he had poured a bottle of sulfuric acid that he had found on one of the storage shelves. He then sat down in front of Dylan. "Are you awake now?" Bosch asked. "The fuck is this?" Dylan answered. "Who are you?" "Doesn't matter who I am. Tell me about Daisy Clayton." "I don't know what or who you're talking about. Untie me right the fuck now." "Sure you do. 9 years ago. The child hooker on Sunset you grabbed from out front of the liquor store? She had to be your first, I'm thinking, or one of your first, before you had this setup, back when you had to worry about where and how to get rid of the bodies." There was a momentary pause in Dylan's response that told Bosch he had thrown a strike. "You're crazy, and you're going to jail," Dylan said. "All this? Illegal. Doesn't matter what I tell you. I could say I killed Kennedy, Tupac, and Biggie Smalls, and it wouldn't matter. This is all illegal search and seizure. I'm not even a cop, and I know that, so just call it in, motherfucker. Let's get this over with." Bosch leaned back in the desk chair. It squeaked. "One problem with all that," he said. "I'm not a cop. I'm not here to call anything in. I'm here for Daisy Clayton. That's it." "Bullshit," Dylan said. "I can tell. You're a cop." "Tell me about Daisy." "Nothing to tell. I don't know her." "You grabbed her that night. You took her." "Whatever, man. I want a lawyer." "There are no lawyers here. We're past that." "Then do what you gotta do, bro. I'm not saying shit." His chair squeaking, Bosch reached down to the bucket containing the acid. He carefully lifted it and moved it to a spot between Dylan's spread legs. "What are you doing?" Dylan asked. Bosch said nothing. The fumes from the acid did the talking. "Is that the sulfuric?" Dylan asked, panic rising in his voice. "I can smell it. What the fuck are you doing?" "What's the matter, Roger?" Bosch said. "You say I'm a cop, right? I won't do anything to hurt you. Not if it's illegal." "All right. Okay, I believe you. You're not a cop. Just get that stuff away from me. You don't want to fuck with it. The fumes alone can..." "Wait a minute. What did you pour it into? It eats through metal. You know that, right?" "Then I guess we don't have a lot of time. Daisy Clayton. Tell me about her." "I told you." Dylan suddenly abandoned his argument and started screaming, "Help!" at the top of his lungs. Bosch did nothing, and after 20 seconds, Dylan stopped, knowing the effort was useless. "Ironic, huh?" Bosch said. "You designed and built this place so nobody could get out, and nobody could hear anybody's calls for help. And now, here we are. Go ahead. Keep on screaming." "Look, please. I'm sorry," Dylan said. "I'm sorry if I upset you. I'm sorry if I ever did any..." Bosch reached out with his foot and slid the bucket a few inches closer to Dylan's crotch. Dylan tried to lean back, but there was no place for his body to go. He turned his face to the right. "Please," he said. "The fumes, it's getting in my lungs." "I read a story in the newspaper once," Bosch replied. "It was about this guy who got sulfuric acid spilled on his hands. He quickly put his hands under a faucet to wash it off, and that only made it hurt worse. Water more than doubles the pain, but if you don't flush the acid, it will eat right through your skin." "Jesus Christ," Dylan said. "What do you want?" "You know what I want. I want the story. Daisy Clayton, 2009. Tell me the story." Dylan kept his face turned away from the fumes. "Get it away," he cried. "It's burning my lungs." 2009, Bosch said, as he sat back in the chair and it squeaked again. "Look, what do you want?" Dylan said. "You want me to say I did it? Fine, I did it. Whatever it is, I did it. So let's just call the cops. I know you're not a cop, but let's call the cops and I'll tell them I did it. I promise. I'll tell them. I'll tell them I did the others too, as many as you want. I'll tell them I did them all." Bosch reached into his pocket for the mini recorder he had retrieved from his car. "How many others?" he asked. "Tell me their names." He hit the record button. Dylan shook his head and then kept it turned away from the bucket. "Jesus," Dylan said. "This is crazy." Bosch put his thumb over the microphone. "Give me a name, Dylan. You want to get out of here? You want me to call the cops? Give me a name." I can't believe you if you can't give me a name. He freed the microphone. Please, let me go, Dylan said. I won't tell anyone about this. I'll just forget about it. Just let me go, please. Bosch gave the bucket another push with his foot. It was now touching the inner seam of Dylan's jeans. He covered the microphone again, and whenever he spoke. Last chance, Roger, he said. You start talking, or I start walking. I leave the bucket, and maybe it burns through, and maybe it doesn't. No, you can't do this, Dylan said. Please, I didn't do anything. But you just said you did the others. Which is it? All right, whatever. I killed them. I killed them all, okay? Tell me their names. Tell me one name, then I can believe you. That Daisy girl. Her. No, I gave you that name. You have to give me a name. I don't have any names. That's really too bad. Bosch stood up, as if to leave. The chair squeaked, underlining his intentions. Sarah Bender! Bosch stood still. The name had a slight resonance, but he couldn't place it. He put his thumb on the mic. Who? He released his thumb. Sarah Bender. She's the only name I know. I remember her because that one made the papers. Her father didn't give a shit about her until she was missing. Then it was boo-hoo all over the news. Thumb on. And you killed her? Thumb off. Dylan nodded quickly. She was out front of a coffee shop, I remember, because it was only a block from the LAPD station. I grabbed her right under their fucking noses. Thumb on. What did you do with her afterward? Thumb off. Dylan nodded in the direction of the corner where the incinerator was located. I burned her. Bosch paused. What about Daisy Clayton? Her too. You didn't have the burner then. No. I was working out of my own garage then, just getting the business started. So what did you do? I cleaned her with bleach. I didn't have my acid permits yet. You used your bathtub? No. I put her in one of my bio containers with a top. I filled it with bleach and left it like that for a day. Rode around with it while I worked. Who else besides Daisy and Sarah? I told you, I can't remember their names. What about the most recent one? The girl with the pink fingernails. What was her name? I don't remember. Sure you do. You had her in the back of that truck. What was her name? Don't you see? I never asked her name. I didn't care. Their names didn't matter. Nobody missed them. Nobody cared. They didn't count. Bosch stared down at him for a long moment. He had what he needed in the way of confirmation. But he wasn't done. What about their parents? Their mothers. Did they count? Most of the girls out there, I got news for you, their parents didn't give a shit about them. Bosch thought about Elizabeth Clayton and her sad end. He put it all on Dylan. He pocketed the recorder and reached down to the bucket. He picked it up, ready to dump its fiery contents over Dylan's head. Even blinded by the tape, Dylan knew the decision Bosch was making.
Don't,
he said pleadingly. Bosch reached down to the bucket of water. He quietly lifted it and put it down between Dylan's legs, making sure to slosh the liquid. He then put the bucket of acid down to the side.
Jesus, be careful, Dylan exclaimed.
Bosch picked up the roll of duct tape and started wrapping tape around Dylan and the barrel, making sure he could not get up or go anywhere. He did two turns around Dylan's neck, leaving him the ability to keep his face turned from the bucket. When he was finished, he tore off a small piece of tape, pulled the recorder from his pocket, wiped all sides and buttons against his shirt, then taped it to Dylan's chest. You sit tight now, he said. Where are you going? Dylan demanded. To get the police, like you asked.
And you're just going to leave me here?
That's the plan.
You can't do that. Sulfuric is very volatile. It could eat through the bucket.
I'll be quick. Bosch patted Dylan on the shoulder in a supportive way. He then picked up the bucket containing the acid and walked toward the door he had unlocked for Ballard. He left it unlocked behind him. Outside, Bosch walked into the narrow passageway between Dylan's warehouse and the one next door. He poured the acid out on top of the accumulated debris and discarded the bucket there as well. He then exited the passage and walked towards his Jeep. Chapter 49. Van Nuys' division was less than a mile away. Bosch drove there. This was not because he had any intention of speaking to the police in person, but because it was the only place he knew of in the area that still had operating payphones. There was a bank of them at the bottom of the stairs below the station's main exit, placed there as a convenience for inmates who were released from the station's jail and needed to call loved ones or lawyers for pickup. Bosch no longer had the SIS phone. Cespedes had asked for it back when Bosch announced that he was leaving the Cortez shooting scene and catching a ride with the patrol officer back to his car. Next to the phone bank, there was also a change machine, but it only took $5 bills. Bosch had two calls to make, but reluctantly cashed a five into 20 quarters. He first called Ballard's number from memory, and she answered right away. He admitted to Daisy and to others, he said. Too many for him to even remember. Jesus, Ballard said. He just told you all of this? Who were the others? He only remembered one name, and that was because it made news, and there was some heat at the time. Sarah Bender. You remember her? Her dad was some kind of a big shot, according to Dylan. I remember the name, but can't place the case. I want to use it as the control case. I brought up Daisy, but he brought up Sarah Bender. If we can confirm it, we can. Confirm it, I mean. Sarah Bender's dad has that club on Sunset. Bender's on the Strip. There's usually a line out the door. Right. I know it. Down near the Roxy. Sarah disappeared about 3 years ago. George Bender went very public, hired private eyes to find her. Supposedly he even went to the dark side for help when he didn't think the LAPD was seriously looking for her. What's that mean? The dark side, Bosch asked. You know, he had connections outside the law working on it. Mercenary types. There was a rumor that his backers in the club were organized crime. When his daughter went missing, that became part of the investigation, but it didn't pan out. I think the official line was that she was a runaway. It may have looked that way. She wasn't a runaway. Dylan grabbed her outside a coffee shop. I remember the father also put up a reward. They started getting sightings all over the country. People who wanted to cash in. Eventually it all went away and now it's just another L.A. mystery. Well, mystery solved. He said he killed her. Put her in the incinerator. Motherfucker. How'd you get him to tell you about that? Doesn't matter. He did and I didn't feed him the name. He came out with it. He said her and Daisy. The rest he couldn't remember by name. Not even the woman with the pink fingernails. There was a pause before Ballard spoke. What did he say about her? Nothing. He said he never knew her name in the first place, let alone forgot it. Did you ask when he grabbed her? No, I guess I should have. I think it was recent. When I was in the back of that truck, I could smell her fear. I knew that's where he kept her. Bosch didn't know how to respond to that, but it fed into the frustration and anger growing in him. The more he thought about it, the more he regretted dumping out the sulfuric acid on the ground and not on Dylan's head. Ballard spoke again before he could. Is he still alive? I'll probably regret it the rest of my life, but yeah, he's alive. No, it's just, never mind. What will you do with him now? I'll call it in, let Van Nuys sort it out. Do you have him on tape? Yes, but it won't matter. Inadmissible. They'll have to start over, build a case. I'll tell them to start with the inside of that truck. Fingerprints, DNA. There was a long pause as they both contemplated how their illegal actions had imperiled any sort of traditional way of bringing Dylan to justice. Ballard finally spoke. Let's hope something's there, she said. I don't want him walking free again. He won't, Bosch said. I promise you that. More silence followed as they considered what Bosch had just said. It was time to hang up, but Bosch didn't want to. He realized it might be the last time they would speak. Their relationship had been held together by the case. Now the case was over. I need to make the call, Bosch finally said. Okay, Ballard said. I guess maybe I'll see you around, okay? Sure. Stay in touch. Bosch hung up. It was a weird ending. He jangled the change in his hand as he thought about how to handle the call that would send investigators to Dylan's warehouse. He needed to protect himself, but wanted to make sure that the call created an urgent response. He dropped quarters into the phone slot, but then his intentions were hijacked. Thoughts of Elizabeth Clayton hit him, and a deep grief washed over him as he imagined her sad ending, alone in a seedy motel room, empty pill bottle on the bed table, haunted by the ghost of her lost daughter. Then he remembered Dylan's dismissal of his victims as women and girls who didn't count or matter, and suddenly he was filled with anger. He wanted revenge. When the dial tone pulled him out of his dark reverie, he punched in 411 and asked the operator for the number of benders on the strip. He was about to drop in more quarters to make the call when caution pushed through the red glare of vengeance. He turned and looked up into the overhang of the police building. He counted at least two cameras. He hung up the phone and walked away. Bosch moved through the government plaza toward Van Nuys Boulevard, where he had parked the Jeep. He popped the back hatch and reached in for his bad weather attire, a Dodgers cap, and an army jacket with a high collar that offered protection from wind and rain. He put them on, closed the hatch, and crossed the street to a row of 24-hour bail bonds offices. At the end of the row was a payphone, attached to the side wall of the building. He pulled his hat down and his collar up as he approached. He dropped in quarters and made the call, checking his watch while he waited for it to ring. It was 1:45 a.m., and he knew the clubs on Sunset Strip would close at 2. The call was answered by a woman whose voice was engulfed by a background of loud electronic music. "Is there an office?" Bosch yelled. "Give me the office." He was put on hold for nearly a minute before a male voice answered. "Mr. Bender?"
"He's not here. Who's this, please?"
Bosch didn't hesitate. "This is the Los Angeles police. I need to speak to Mr. Bender right now. It's an emergency. It's about his daughter."
"Is this bullshit? The guy's been through enough with you people."
"This is very serious, sir. I have news about his daughter, and I need to speak with him right now. Where can I reach him?"
"Hold on."
He was put on hold for another minute, and then another male voice came on the line.
"Who is this?"
"Mr. Bender?"
"I said, who is this?"
"It doesn't matter who this is. I'm sorry to be so blunt with news that is so bad, but your daughter was murdered 3 years ago, and the man who killed her is sitting in a..."
"Who the fuck is this?"
"I am not going to tell you that, sir. What I am going to do is give you an address where you will find the man who killed your daughter waiting for you. The door will be unlocked."
"How can I believe you? You call up here out of the blue, won't give your name. How do I..."
"Mr. Bender, I'm sorry. I can't give you any more than what I have, and I need to do it now before I change my mind." Bosch let that hang in the darkness between them for a bit. "Do you want the address?" he finally asked.
"Yes," Bender said. "Give it to me."
Chapter 50. After supplying Bender with the Satakoi address, Bosch hung up without a further word. He left the phone and started across the deserted boulevard, back toward his car. A collision of thoughts went through his head. Faces came too. Elizabeth's face, and her daughter's, known to him only in photos. Bosch thought about his own daughter, and about George Bender losing his, and the blinding grief something like that would bring. He realized then that he had put Bender on a path that would simply trade a momentary urge for justice and vengeance for another kind of guilt and grief. For both of them. In the middle of the boulevard, Bosch turned around. He went back to the payphone for one final call. He dialed a direct line to Valley Bureau Detectives and asked for the investigator working the late show. He got a detective named Palmer and told him that there was a killer left bound and waiting for him in a warehouse on Satakoi. He said there was a recorder with a confession on it that should jumpstart an investigation and prosecution. There was evidence in the back of a truck in the warehouse as well. He gave him the exact address and told him to hurry.
"Why's that?" Palmer asked. "Sounds like this guy isn't going anywhere."
"Because you've got competition," Bosch said.
Ballard and Bosch. Epilogue. Bosch came out of the glass doors of the medical examiner's office and found Ballard waiting for him, leaning on the front wall. Is it her? Bosch nodded somberly.
But I knew it would be.
I'm sorry. He nodded his thanks. He noticed that her hair was wet and slicked back. She noticed him noticing. I was on my board this morning when you left the message. First time I've been able to get out on the water after my shift in a while.
You took the Scooby-Doo van?
I did. They started walking down the steps toward the parking lot. You checked the newspaper this morning?
Not yet. What did they have?
They had a story about the SIS thing up in the valley, but it happened so late they didn't get many details in. There will probably be a fuller story online today and in the paper tomorrow.
Yeah, SIS means headlines. They'll be all over it for days. Anything about Dylan?
Not in the paper, but I got a call last night from Valley Bureau.
What did they say?
They were looking for guidance on the Daisy Clayton case. They knew I had been working it. They said they picked up a guy who they think was good for her killing, among others. They were tipped to him by someone calling himself a concerned citizen, like Batman or something. Identity unknown.
Did they say whether they can make a case?
They said the taped confession was no good, but otherwise they had enough probable cause to get a judge to give them a search warrant for the truck inside the warehouse.
That's good. Hopefully they'll find.
They already did. Prints and DNA. If they get matches to any missing women, then Dylan goes down. Probably not for Clayton, though. That'll be a long shot after so many years.
I guess all that matters is that he's taken off the board.
Ballard nodded. Funny thing. While they were at the warehouse, a car pulls up and then takes off. The guy I'm dealing with, Detective Palmer, he has patrol chase the car down, and guess who's in it?
No idea.
George Bender and a couple bouncers from his joint on the strip. Sarah Bender's father, who we had just talked about last night.
Strange.
Even stranger is that he says he was told by an anonymous caller that the guy in the warehouse killed his daughter. They check his trunk and find a chainsaw. Just sitting in his trunk. A frickin' chainsaw. Bosch shrugged, but Ballard wasn't finished. Makes me think this Batman guy was trying to play both ends against the middle. Palmer even said that his caller told him to hurry because he had competition. So I'm glad you called me today, Harry, because I wanted to ask you what the fuck you were doing last night. Bosch stopped so he could turn and face her. He shrugged.
Look, I was following the plan, and then I started thinking about Elizabeth, okay? It's like he murdered her, too, if you ask me. So I got angry, and I made a call. But then I corrected it, and everything turned out okay.
Barely. It could easily have gone the other way.
And would that have been so bad?
That's not the question. The question is that how we do things? Bosch shrugged again and continued toward his car. Was that why you wanted to meet? To explain calling Bender?
No. I actually wanted to talk about something else.
About what?
I was thinking that we worked pretty well together. Like we were a good team on this.
They stopped at the Cherokee. Okay. We were a good team. What are you saying? Bosch shrugged.
That maybe we keep working on cases together. You know, you find them. I find them. I'm outside. You're inside. We see what we can get done.
And then what? You do your Batman thing and decide who we call at the end of the case?
No, I told you it was a mistake and I corrected it. That won't happen. You can call the shots on that stuff if you like.
What about money? I get paid and you don't? We split my check, what?
I don't want your money or anybody else's. My pension's probably higher than your paycheck anyway. I just want what you've got, Renee. Not too many have it.
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. You know, you have that thing. Maybe 1 in 100 have it. You've got scars on your face, but nobody can see them. It's because you're fierce. You keep pushing. I mean, I'd be dog food right now if it wasn't for what you've got.
so let's work together. Let's work cases, badge, no badge, it doesn't matter. I'm past all of that now anyway. I don't know how much time I've got left, but whatever I have, I want to use it to go out there and find people like Dylan. And one way or another, take them off the board.
Ballard had her hands in her pockets. She was looking down at the asphalt when Bosch said all those things about her. Things she knew were true, especially about the scars. She nodded. Okay, Harry. We can work cases. But we bend the rules. We don't break them. Bosch nodded back.
That sounds right.
Where do we start?
I don't know. Just call me when it's time. I'll be around.
Okay. I'll send up a signal. They shook hands on it and went their separate ways. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Dark Sacred Night. Written by Michael Connelly. Read by Christine Lakin and Titus Welliver. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Sound editing by Sean Bolter. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Dark Sacred Night is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Hieronymus, Inc. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.